Or maybe this is the bathroom.
Yeah, that's...
You're right. This is the bathroom.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. The hell did I do? Kill them all. Of course.
Now, have you ever talked to this Sarab Kaufman, because he's sort of the guy that this new letter hinges on and everything, and a lot of people are sort of, they raise their suspicions, because it's like, how did this thing go undiscovered for all these years? So I guess, what do you make of this guy and how the whole thing went down as far as them finding this letter?
Well, I interviewed Sarab years ago. I didn't know anything about the letter. When I spoke with Jarecki after the final episode of the Jinx, I'd asked him about that, because I thought it kind of looked staged to me.
Right.
The whole, we had to go over to the apartment, Sarab's got something for us to read, he's shaking, he's upset. It seemed as if, they had gone through this before. I have no doubt they came up with a letter. Just the way that they portrayed it was a little too dramatic. So I asked him about it. He said that it appeared the way it actually happened. So, at this point, you have to take him at his word. He could be, any event at Susan Berman, that Durst is tried for the Susan Berman murder, Jarecki and his co-producer, Mark Smerling, could potentially be called as witnesses.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure they'll be questioned on that, along with a lot of other things. But the letter apparently existed, but the significance of the letter and this cadaver note, in the book I wrote, I'm not sure about the significance of it, in that it was interesting in the Jinx, but they already had Durst handwriting samples, particularly, years ago when they went to Galveston and the Los Angeles police had done a handwriting analysis, and their first analyst said, yes, definitely, it's a match. For some reason along the way, they did a second one, and the second guy wasn't so sure that, maybe, but who knows. And it kind of muddied up the waters for them as far as prosecuting was concerned. What the guys in the Jinx did was they got other copiers' handwriting, which is what the police could have easily have done too. So I'm not sure of exactly what was going on there.
Oh, yeah.
With the handwriting and all of that. Obviously, the key thing here is that Beverly and Beverly Hills was misspelled, not just in the cadaver letter, but also in this particular letter.
Hmm.
So that's the general link there. And, of course, there could be some DNA evidence linking Durst to those letters.
Right.
It's something that I've heard of. It's something that's been hinted to me, but it's something I'm not sure about.
Right, because that's how they were kind of trying to, that's what they keep doing to the Zodiac, though. They keep pulling the stuff off the stamp and trying to match it to people. So it stands to reason if there's a stamp on it, maybe he, or licked the envelope or something. Yeah, makes sense. One of the other sort of like big tentpoles of sort of contention or discussion amongst the people who look at this thing is the idea of the role of the Durst Corporation, the Durst family. Obviously, it's changed over the years. Now they want nothing to do with this guy. They see him as a complete nut and a dangerous individual. But when it all went down with the disappearance of Kathy, they took a quote-unquote hands-off approach, and makes you almost... But then there's always people who speculate on what really was going on. And, in the book, it kind of suggests the idea, because Strzok is talking to one of his colleagues, and they're sort of reflecting on how they're not under a lot of pressure to solve this case. They're not under, the big players in the police brass aren't breathing down their neck to get to the bottom of this. So it almost speaks to like an anti-conspiracy in a way, where it was like maybe the strings were being pulled just to let it go, just let this thing go. Don't go after what really happened, in a sense. So I mean, but what's your take on sort of the ideas behind what the Durst, the Durst Enterprise may have done behind the scenes on all this?
Well, Kathy Durst was a blue-collar woman from Long Island. So, you know, she wasn't part of any power structure. She wasn't, you know, she didn't come from wealth. So, in effect, yes, she was Bobby's wife. But as far as that went, once she no longer was his wife, they retreated and they did nothing to help the police, nor did they do anything to help the McCormick family. There's a scene in the book, which is a really troubling scene, in which the family, led by Jim McCormick, the brother, finally, after months, they get a meeting with Seymour Durst, Bobby's father. You know, now Seymour is he's the big man. He's the guy that was on the cover of New York Magazine, Five Most Powerful Men in New York.
Yeah.
Donald Trump and several other guys. And Seymour is listening, and he's not offering them anything. And then one of Durst's other brothers, Bobby Durst, Tom Durst, walks in, sees everyone there, says, what's going on? They, you know, when he finds out that they're there to try to get Seymour to help them, he throws everybody out. So Durst, and then in turn, because of who Kathy was, there was no effort and there was no lobbying on the part of anyone on the police or on any other law enforcement to solve this case. Now, there's another story. You know, Strzok, before this happened, he solved the murder at the Met, which was a high-profile case a couple of years earlier, and he gained him a lot of notoriety. And there was a ton of pressure placed on him, as well as the police department, to solve that murder. Nothing was going on with Kathy Durst, which is another reason why this whole thing just kind of went away during 4 or 5 months of investigating.
Hmm. And that kind of continues, in a sense, in the later years, because the thing about the book that really blew my mind, too, was the timeline of the Berman thing. You know, the popular narrative is that that Jeanine Pirro puts forward all the time is that they were just about to go talk to her. It was, you know, days away they were going to go talk to her. And then you find out from reading A Deadly Secret that they hadn't even contacted her or anything. And you know, the investigators in New York found out she was dead after the new year when they called to get a hold of her. So it's
That's another revelation and a really important point that the Jinx just didn't get right. And in fact, if for those who remember the Jinx, in one of the first few episodes, Jeanine Pirro had a really big role in this, I don't know why, is telling the world that she not only got the tip to restart this investigation, but that she was about to interview Susan Berman. And she's now, whether she's talking, it sounds like she's talking about herself, or even if she's talking about her department, you know, she's saying, we were going to talk to her. It never happened. In fact, Jeanine Pirro was so far removed from this case. All she did was, from time to time, I'll give you an example. When just before word broke of this new investigation in 2000, the investigator that actually started this all, a guy by the name of Joe Becerra, and if you saw the Jinx, you won't even remember who he is because he was only on it for about 15 seconds.
Yeah.
He was the key figure in getting this case started up again. He's the one who got the tip. He's the one who labored for a year investigating. He gets to a point where they got this meeting where he brings in the McCormicks, Kathy's friends, including Roberta that we mentioned earlier. They have this big meeting, and he's about to go talk to Bobby, and of course someone from that meeting leaks it to the press. Jeanine Pirro wasn't even at the meeting. She pokes her head in, as I described in the book, says hello to people, and walks away.
Yeah.
Jeanine Pirro got involved in this case once she was informed that Susan Berman was murdered. And that came after Berman had died. It was when Joe Becerra, in early January of 2001, called to Los Angeles just to give him a courtesy call, just to let them know he was going to interview someone in their jurisdiction. They said, who is it? It's a woman by the name of Susan Berman. They put him on hold. They come back, she's dead. And Becerra's like, what?
Yeah.
he goes and tells Pirro. The next thing you know, now the case takes on this whole, it goes to this bizarre level. Now Jeanine Pirro is on CNN. She's on every news network you can think of, telling the world that, a witness is dead and clearly it looks like it was Bobby. And she's just soaking up all this TV FaceTime. One, because she's running for re-election. Two, the bigger reason is because she's got personal problems because her husband's about to be indicted on federal tax charges. So, you know, so her role in this whole thing was more about, and as you read in the book, I get into it pretty deeply, it was more about her trying to use this case for its publicity value.
Yeah.
And to not only cover up the warts of her life, but also to, at the end of the day, you know, catapult her to perhaps political prominence. You know, she did run for office in New York in 2005, and she subsequently lost. And, of course, now she's a host on, you know, weekend host on Fox News. And what was interesting was after the jinx aired, and she was basically hailed as a heroine here, and she repeated the same story, how she was going to interview Susan Berman.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, she's got this writer who I'm not going to name her. I mean, she wrote a story for Matt, which I wrote about actually in the book, that was very favorable to Pirro back then. And she just wrote another one in Bloomberg saying the same thing, that it was Pirro acting on a tiff who's going to interview Susan Berman. I mean, it's you know, it's bizarre. But it's also sad because Pirro's actions had a direct effect on the progress of this investigation. It prevented other jurisdictions from looking at Bobby Durst. We're talking about Galveston. We're talking about Los Angeles. We're also talking about Northern California, which I mentioned earlier, where they've got two missing women up there they believe could be victims of Durst. So, you know, Pirro did more harm to this case, far more harm than good.
And, you know, it's like we were talking about how there's all these different kind of villains in the book. It's in the story, really. It's amazing. It really is. It's really, really, really amazing. It's what makes the story so captivating, I think, is because you have these you have Durst, who's this enigma, an evil enigma. And then you've got these other players who are sort of taking advantage of it all for their own agendas, notably Gilberti and Gilberta and Pirro. So it's very, very... it's very bizarre. Now, I guess we have a short amount of time here, so let's sort of take it up to the present. I mean, what do you think? From what I guess the very, very latest on all this is that Durst, he's been arrested for weapons charges, because when they first arrested him for the murder, they found a gun and some grass, and originally they were he was charged with that stuff in New Orleans, but now the feds have taken over the case. I guess what's the I don't understand really the whole significance of that. So explain that to me, why the feds would take it out of the hands of the New Orleans police, and what you think's going on here with all this legal machinations with Durst.
Well, the FBI got involved in 2012, and that was from another case which they thought Durst may be associated with, and it's a case on Long Island in New York. In which they found the remains of roughly a dozen women off the beach on southern Long Island, and some of them were dismembered. Some were prostitutes, some were homeless. So the FBI first thought that perhaps Durst could be associated with that. They couldn't connect him to any of these women, but during this period of time, they became intrigued with the Kathy Durst investigation. So starting in 2012, they began working with New York authorities as well as with Los Angeles on the two investigations there in what was described to me as a very loose task force. So the FBI has been on this for several years now. It was the FBI that actually arrested Durst the night before the final airing of the jinx, believing that he was going to flee the country. And so now he's facing... So Durst is now facing not just murder charges in Los Angeles for Susan Berman. He's facing weapons charges in New Orleans, which could give him some significant jail time. And that trial begins or scheduled to begin in September. Whatever the outcome of New Orleans, he's going to face trial ultimately in Los Angeles. And so prosecutors there, they were just in New York a couple of weeks ago talking to witnesses and they spent about a week here. And so they're working on their case. I don't think that they would have charged Durst unless they believe that they have very solid evidence. So they're moving forward. What's good about all of this, though, the fact that the New Orleans trial was delayed, is it's given the FBI now an opportunity to look, as I mentioned earlier, in cities across the country, and there's a lot of them, where Durst has lived before, and where he has assumed different identities, where he's lived amongst the homeless. And we're talking in cities from coast to coast. One town in Vermont, you may recall last month, said that Durst was a suspect in the disappearance of a woman there, going back to 1972. And she disappeared in front of a health food store that Durst had owned. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. He's in prison right now. He's going to be there for a long time. I don't think he'll ever get out.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, there will be a trial in New Orleans, and likely there'll be a trial in Los Angeles.
Okay. Maybe you can explain this to me. Let's say he goes on trial in New Orleans under the federal charges, and he's found guilty of the gun stuff. So he's already got, like, say, a 10-year sentence, right? Does he go right to L.A., though, for the murder charge, or are they gonna, or is it the kind of thing where he sits around for 10 years, then they charge him? How's that work?
That's a good question. Frankly, that's a question I'm asking, and I haven't gotten an answer back yet. It would depend on the authorities. It would, you know, being that he's already been convicted in New Orleans, he's going to be in prison there for a while. It would give Los Angeles time. They wouldn't be in any rush to bring him to trial.
Yeah.
But whether or not it would happen quickly or not, frankly, I'm not too sure on yet.
And because the frustrating part is, for, I don't know how you feel, but I consider myself sort of an armchair student of the case now, and it's like, I want to see the trial. I want to see the L.A. trial. Like, the weapons, if he goes to jail for the weapons and we never find out what the case is against him in L.A., I don't know, it's going to be kind of, it's going to be like a loose thread that'll drive me crazy.
Well, the L.A. trial is going to be really important in that he's charged with killing Susan Berman because she was a witness in the murder of another woman. And that other woman is Kathy Durst. So if he's convicted in killing Susan Berman, then that would give New York authorities a motive. And they haven't been able to charge him yet. The evidence that New York has is purely circumstantial. It's good evidence, but it's nothing that they can really hang their hat on. Having a conviction in Los Angeles would go a long way to having New York file charges.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Like you said, they wouldn't charge him unless they had a really good case. And it's like, I tend to agree with you, but I'm wondering what what that is. And especially, too, there's the hope that if they do the murder trial in L.A., that maybe, because they said there's like 6 hours plus of interviews with this guy from the Jinx. I want to see those, too. I want those to be, like, entered into evidence so people like you and me can watch them and see if there's anything that other people have missed.
My understanding is that's exactly what the prosecutors in Los Angeles did when they were in New York a week or two ago. And that is, they looked at the outtakes, the other interviews that weren't aired.
And do you think that it's going to be a situation, well, I presume Jarecki and the other guy will have to go on trial, and then it's going to be like, or go on the stand, and then it's going to be a situation where, how involved were they with the police? They say they weren't involved much at all. It's interesting because they're kind of like, they've pulled out of the whole thing now because they're going to be, they presume they'll be witnesses in the trial, right?
Like, yeah, they're on lockdown now. I'm sure under orders from their attorneys. You know, look, the Jinx did a lot in terms of bringing the Durst story to national prominence, but there was a lot, as we discussed, in the Jinx that was lacking, and they're going to have to answer for that.
Right, right. It's funny because, you know, they came out of it where everybody, there's a lot of questions about Durst. There's a lot of questions about the show, too, that people are left to kind of wonder about. It's a really, it's one of the most puzzling cases, stories that I've ever seen, Matt. I really, I've been captivated by it. And I, like I said, I really do, I appreciate you coming on the show. I appreciate I really appreciate the work you did on the book. I think it's outstanding. How many folks did you talk to over the course of the making of this?
Oh, I mean, I spent the better part of a year researching and writing it, reporting on it. So I spoke to everyone that's in the book and multiply it by 5 or 6.
Now, I presume it probably would have been in the book, but I presume you never talked to Durst or anything like that. Did you ever, aside from the fact that you heard he was mad about Gilberta, from the book, like, did you ever hear what his reaction to the whole thing was or anything? I mean, you know he had 2 copies of your book. with him when he was arrested. I guess what do you think his thoughts on it all were?
Well, I'm sure he thought the book was important for him to have two copies with him. At first, when I first got word he had copies, you know, I got a call from a producer from one of the network morning shows who said they just opened a search warrant and that Durst had three books and two of them were yours. And so I was a little stunned at first. And then the more I thought about it, you know, the book is a roadmap into Durst's life, especially the latter part of his life where he lived this very disturbing lifestyle.
Mm.
And the police have read the book. They know it. And I'm sure Durst kept the book close by as, you know, as reference material. I'm also now thinking that perhaps given his penchant for publicity, this is more of a recent thing, that, you know, perhaps he, you know, like seeing himself on the cover and, you know, reading about himself in, on the inside. But I think it was more about the fact that a lot of his life had been revealed in the book. He knew it, and he just wanted to keep it by his side.
It's pretty creepy. It was unsettling. So you've never had contact with Durst or anything like that. So he's never like.
No, I covered the Galveston trial, and I saw him there, and I covered his extradition from Pennsylvania. I never had an opportunity to speak to him. He was very, you know. In addition, he wasn't talking to anybody back then.
Yeah.
This whole new thing, you know, him not just talking to Jarecki, but smiling. He's got this really creepy-looking smile.
And writing that crazy letter to
with the
LA Times.
On. And, yeah, and then writing a letter to a reporter at the LA Times. I mean, that's a guy, that's a whole new Bobby Durst. Excuse me. It's one I had never seen before, and, you know, it's a whole new, it's a whole new look for him.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, this is the sort of what happens next for you part. What do you got cooking? What are you working on? Obviously, the Durst thing isn't your only research project. You got a couple other books that have been out in the past. But, you know, what can people expect from Matt Birkbeck next?
The Durst was my very first book, and I've written four others after that. My last one is called The Quiethon, which came out about a year and a half ago. So I've been working on a couple of other projects, one of which is now an ending for another book I have called The Beautiful Child, which told the story of a young woman who was kidnapped as a toddler by another psychopath who raised her as his daughter.
Oh, God.
And it's a brutal story, but it's also an amazing story about this young woman who went on to become the standout student. Unfortunately, you know, life took a 180 on her, and you know, for people who may want to read the book, I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In any event, what is known about the book is we never were able to find her identity. I get into the subject of missing children in America in the book.
Oh, and really? I got to check this.
We were never able to find her identity. I did get a call from the FBI last fall, and they did find her identity. So I'm adding perhaps two new chapters to that book. I already spoke with my publisher, Penguin, and she agreed. And so I'm actually going to finish that up in the early part of the summer. And the complete book now, you know, is the one thing, these stories that I cover, they're great stories, man. You know, unfortunately, just no great ending.
Well, they're unfolding almost, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, wow, it's a great story. And then you get to the end, and it's like, what? And unfortunately, these are the stories that I tackle.
Yeah.
So with Durst, we're getting close to an ending. You know, the new book, the republished book, we've added new chapters to it, and it takes us right up until the last couple of weeks. And then in The Beautiful Child, which is still an amazing story, and it was published 10 years ago, and it continues to sell. And people read it in the emails they send me. It's just one of these unforgettable stories. And, you know, happily, at least I say happily for myself, in that we can give this girl her real name and tell the world where she came from and who she really was. So after that, I got a couple of other things that I'm working on. Nothing I can really disclose right now.
Yeah, I understand.
I'm busy.
Nice. Now, I guess as the final question, do you think we'll ever really know the whole story here? You know, there's always the chance, like you mentioned in that Vulture interview, the ideal scenario is, you know, that he cops a plea and just spills the beans on everything. That would be fantastic. But there's a part of me that's like, haunts me that we're never going to really know exactly the true story, the true life of Robert Durst. He's always going to be sort of like under this cloud of suspicion and possibility of all this devious stuff he might have been up to. So do you think we'll ever really kind of know the whole thing?
Well, like, the fantasy ending is him agreeing to tell the world who he killed, when he killed him, and where. And then he goes to prison for life, and we never see or hear from him again. But unfortunately, I doubt that would happen. I'm not going to say, you know, with all certainty it wouldn't happen, but I kind of doubt it. And I think it will. It's going to be really – in my – believing that there are other victims out there, I'm sure a lot of them will never be found.
Hmm.
My hope is that the FBI will not just solve the two remaining murders, Susan Berman and Kathy Durst, that we know of. They'll also be able to resolve the two in Northern California, including Karen Mitchell, the one up in way up north in California, in Eureka. They'll be able to resolve that, as well as the one in Vermont, just to bring closure to the families. Especially
yeah.
the Kathy Durst case. Her family, it's been, what, 30 years now?
Yeah,
since
yeah.
she's disappeared, longer than that. And, you know, nicest people you'd ever want to meet, and they've had to deal with this for 3 decades now, and, you know, the hope is that they can find closure.
Yeah, yeah. All right, man. Well, I really appreciate the extra time. I'm going to let you get going because I could keep talking and talk your ear off all night, but I know you have things to do, and I do too. So I really do appreciate it, Matt. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really absolutely loved the book. It is A Deadly Secret. Folks, go out and pick it up. If you have seen The Jinx, read this book. It should be required reading for anyone who's seen The Jinx because this fills in so much more detail and tells the real story of Robert Durst's bizarre life, and it really is required reading for anybody who checked it out. And if you haven't seen The Jinx, read this book, folks, because this is amazingly well written too. I got to give you credit, Matt. It reads fantastically well. I flew through it twice in the past couple weeks. That's how much I liked it. It's really, really something else. It is A Deadly Secret, and you can find out more from Matt at mattburkbeck.com. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, that was Matt Birkbeck. You can find out more from him, as I said, at mattburkbeck.com. And the book we discussed tonight was A Deadly Secret, the bizarre and chilling story of Robert Durst. Let me see. If you're just listening to this program, maybe you're a Durst fan like me, or a Durst head who's been intrigued by this whole thing since they saw The Jinx and is just discovering Banal of America for the first time. We are Banal of America. We are primarily a paranormal show, but tonight I went completely off the beaten path because I wanted to discuss this case so badly. But if you're into the paranormal, sometimes we do some true crime stuff too. You definitely want to check out Banal of America because we have a massive archive. And I should mention, actually, it's a good point here that for folks who really dig this true crime stuff, dig into our couple cruise ship mysteries episodes that we did with Kendall Carver over the last couple of years, because that's a story that's going to explode as time goes on. But those are just two amongst the 200-plus episodes that can be found in the Banal of America archive. You can find all that at Banal of America. Pretty simple, just punch in BINNALOfAmerica.com. That'll bring you to the website. That'll bring up a whole bunch of stuff, and of course, the BOA Audio Archive. If you are on Facebook and you want to know more about the show, you want to get inside scoops on what's going on with the program and what might be coming up next, you can find all that on Facebook at Banal of America. Just punch that in and like us. As I said, we have 230 episodes plus in the archive. I should really look and see exactly how many at this point, but it's over 230. So the point is, they're there, they're free. Most of the shows are pretty massive. Matt could only give us an hour here. Usually we do a couple of hours and sometimes a couple of hours and change and even a 3 or 4 hour show at times. And you can find all that, of course, in the archive absolutely 100% free. And we do these live programs free, and Blog Talk is not free. So all that stuff comes out of my pocket. I pay for the hosting costs, the bandwidth, and the live stream and all that stuff. So I turn to the BOA Audio listeners for help from time to time to keep us going and keep the whole operation running smoothly and keep me in the black and out of debt. So if you could help us out, folks, that would be greatly appreciated. There's two ways you can do so. Head on over to PayPal, click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a P.O. Box donation, you can do that by going to the address that's listed at Banal of America. Nobody wants to hear me read that. So it's at Banal of America. It's the P.O. Box. And you can find that address there. I'm looking for some listener feedback here, folks. So bear with me while I dig this one up because it's probably some good stuff. Yeah, here it is. All right, because it ties into the next edition of BOA Audio. I didn't mention it here at the beginning of the show, but this is a rare double episode week. We've got another program coming at you in literally 48 hours. I'm going to be talking to Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman about their new book, Mind Wars, because poor Larry fell ill last week and could not do the show. So we had to bump it to this Thursday. We're going to be reunited with the Lennon-McCartney of Paranormal Books, talking about Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman coming back to BOA Audio for their annual visit to talk about their newest book. This one is Mind Wars, and that's going to be Thursday, May 7th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to have all the information up at Banal of America probably tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening, when I get this episode posted. So be sure to check that out. And as I said, I was moving around here looking for the listener feedback. Here is some listener feedback, folks. I had to read this. This is really some of the strangest stuff I've gotten in a while. So after we canceled the Mind Wars episode, I got an email from Camille, or Camille's, I'm not sure, who asks, "What happened to Mind Wars? I heard that woman on Dark Radio and then on Conspiracy Show, and I do not really like her. But I thought I would waste some time hearing you interview her, too. Yet it seems you have chickened out. Go smoke another cigarette that the Rand Corporation paid for with your paycheck." What hurtful words, Camille. What hurtful words. So anyway, I wrote back to Camille and let her know that Larry fell ill. And she should check out the BOA Facebook page where I postponed the episode and asked her to try to be less hateful. But then, God bless her, Camille wrote back and said, "Pardon me, Tim. I know that your services as a man in need of resources for which to live are bought and paid for. I listen to your shows, but only because I need your background noise while working, because I actually like you and how you treat your guests. Your manner of interviewing people is more like a conversation instead of an interrogation. In the end, though, we both know someone is telling you who to interview, so the public eye might be kept off the true and actual conspiratorial ball. I am swinging for the fence, mister, and I do not miss. No hate here, just truth." So Camille is under the impression that I'm on the take from the government, and that's why I canceled the Mind Wars episode. Camille, I'm not on the take from the government. That's insane. That is like the silliest thing I've heard in ages. I laughed all day when I got that email. No one dictates the content of Banal of America except for me and what I find interesting, as evidenced from tonight's Robert Durst heavy episode. There's no grand conspiracy. I'm not sure where that all comes from. Believe me, I wish I was on the take, man. I wish I was on the take. Then I wouldn't have to harass people for PayPal donations and things of that nature at the end of the show. I'm one of the few people who doesn't do subscription services and all these other projects and things to try and wring money out of my fandom and listenership and supporters. So I'm on the up and up, Camille. I promise you. I swear. I'd swear on a stack of Bibles. I'm completely on the up and up. So please. And for the folks who may think that, no. Just no. It's crazy. So with all that said, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, I'm going to go against my Illuminati handlers. I'm going to rise up against the New World Order powers that be who are telling me what to talk about on the show, because on the next edition of BOA Audio in 48 hours, you'll be hearing me discuss Mind Wars with Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, all kinds of stuff dealing with the mysterious and troubling realm of mind control. So for all those folks who want to listen to feedback, you got some here at the end of the show. And for those folks who want more paranormal madness and really almost true crimey stuff too, because we're going to get into cults and stuff, that's going to be on the next edition of BOA Audio with Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman. Thursday, May 7th, 9 p.m., be there or be square. And with all that said, thank you so much for listening, folks. Seriously, go out and check out A Deadly Secret. It is some amazing stuff. If you like hearing a strange, weird story that's true, you got to read this book. And then go see The Jinx, because then you can see this crazy Robert Durst in action and really get the full view of this story. It is some remarkable stuff. And big, big thanks to Matt for coming on the show. He's a big-time author, big-time, you know, publisher behind his book and stuff. So to get him on BOA was really great for us. And I really do appreciate him taking the time to come on the program. So with all that said, thanks to all the listeners out there, the folks who tuned in live, the folks who are listening here on the MP3. And, of course, thank you to the hardcore BOA audio listeners. I know you're listening to this one, too. I know you are, because you're the hardcore BOA audio listeners, and I really do appreciate your enduring support of the program. And to the newcomers, dig into the archive, check out what we've got. With all that said, thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, signing off.